This is the voice of the Trumpet Magazine. News, economy, politics, trends, discovery, health, family, the Bible, the future. This is Trumpet Hour.
Hello, this is Joel Hilliker, managing editor of the Philadelphia Trumpet News Magazine. The Trumpet's publisher and editor-in-chief, Gerald Fleury, just held a personal appearance campaign in Columbus, Ohio, this past Sunday and Monday nights, speaking to Trumpet subscribers. We posted a 27-minute segment from his Sunday night address on thetrumpet.com. The video is called "French President Demands a European Army." I would urge you to watch that important video. Go online to thetrumpet.com and check it out if you haven't seen it yet. A really important segment, and this is going to be included in the Trumpet print edition that we are working on right now. We're sending off to the printer this coming Thursday, but an excellent, excellent address from our editor-in-chief. And in our third segment on the program today, we're going to hear a report on the personal appearance campaign from Mr. Fleury's assistant, Grant Turgeon, who traveled with him. We're going to chat with him about it. He's gotten some interviews from some of the staff who were helping out at the PAC. So this is exciting news of the work, and we're also going to get in that segment an announcement of a new program that will begin airing on Trumpet Radio beginning next Monday. So please do stay tuned for that third segment. We'll also have an interview with our Jerusalem correspondent, Brent Noctegal, who has just returned from a trip to Ashkelon and Sderot in Israel, visiting the sites of this ongoing war taking place with Hamas in the Gaza Strip. We'll get a firsthand account from the battlefront there. And we're going to start and end the program with some discussion related to the 100-year anniversary of the end of World War I. This past Sunday, November 11th, marked 100 years since one of the largest and deadliest wars in history came to a merciful end. And I want to give you one lesson to take from that war. And at the end of the program, I'll give you a related story about a man who tried to save Britain by translating the world's most important book. It has been just 6 years since the last surviving veteran of World War I passed from the scene. Florence Green had joined the Women's Royal Air Force at age 17, a scant 2 months before the war's end, and she died only 2 weeks shy of her 111th birthday. 100 years is a blip in time. This is recent history. But in a world now 3 or 4 generations removed from the Great War, the lessons have been long forgotten. This is a shame. It will have devastating consequences. It already did have, a mere 21 years after that war ended. Unlearned lessons and unresolved conflict exploded into a war that mobilized even larger armies over greater expanses for longer duration and that killed over 6 times as many people. Nations today are arming for a third world war that will eclipse the second more terribly than the second did the first. World War I altered the world utterly and permanently. Advancements in the technology of war making and slaughter made it a shocking nightmare. Just decades before, armies had fought with horses and bayonets. Now they punished one another with machine guns, aircraft, U-boats, railway guns, mustard gas. They dug miles of trenches and draped them in barbed wire, creating a bog of death, a meat grinder into which they hurled millions of their young men. In his book, The Last Lion, Manchester wrote that these were the first men to be exposed to poison gas, massed machine gun fire, and strafing airplanes, and they lived with rats and lice amid the stench of urine, feces, and decaying flesh, staring up at the sky by day and venturing out only by night. Separated by the junk of no man's land, the great impotent armies squatted month after month, living troglodytic lives in candlelit dugouts and trenches. The armies on both sides were colossal. There was one soldier for every 4 inches of front. Improvements in offensive weapons were checked by even greater improvements in defenses, which guaranteed deadlock. Gains were measured in yards, and their cost in scores of thousands of lives. On an average day on the Western Front, 2,533 men were killed in action, 9,121 were wounded, and 1,164 more went missing. The life expectancy for a machine gunner in combat was about 30 minutes. Month after month passed, with neither side making significant gains, while battlefields soaked deeper and deeper with blood. Never before had mankind witnessed such horror and barbarity, and on such a monstrous scale. Winston Churchill became convinced that victory would be bought so dear as to be almost indistinguishable from defeat. He was right. In many ways, World War I was a defeat, not only for the Central Powers, but even for the nations that had subdued them, chief among them the force that had dominated the globe for over a century, the British Empire. When the armistice was signed on November 11, 1918, the world was a changed place. It's true that the British Empire emerged from Versailles with nearly 1 million square miles more territory, inhabited by some 13 million people. However, the empire would never recover from the wealth and manhood it expended, the prestige it sacrificed, the love and loyalty of its peoples and dominions it lost. World War I dealt the era of British dominance and stability a fatal blow. Practically speaking, Britain could simply no longer afford to sustain its vast holdings. The maritime force by which Britannia had ruled the waves had been built on expenditures nearly double that which any other nation was allocating to its navy. After having spent £5 million per day during the war, the war chest was empty. But there was a more elemental crack opened up by the convulsions of the Great War. It seemed the world had passed from the age of heroes into a new age of disillusionment, intellectualism, and cynicism. Manchester wrote, "The war had produced no Marlboroughs, Wellingtons, Nelsons, or Gordons. Kitchener was a tarnished legend," speaking of Britain's decorated Secretary of State for War. "All the British generals had been discredited, with consequences which reached far beyond the British Isles. Before the war, the Empire's overseas subjects had regarded England with affection and respect, proud of their membership in Empire. The colonials assumed that the graduates of Sandhurst were the finest officers in the world. In the trenches, they learned otherwise." Here is how Churchill viewed it, according to Manchester. "Honor, as he understood it, seemed dead in England, and gone with it were innocence, rationalism, optimism, and the very concept of an ordered society. Certainly the sheen of the empire had been stained. A generation before, in the Victorian age, the British sought to serve the world by spreading the advantages of civilization. These efforts weren't executed perfectly, and they didn't come without problems. But it is irrefutable that the British Empire expanded education, improved public health, abolished slavery, expanded women's rights, brought outcast peoples into public life, eradicated cruel pagan practices, increased prosperity and employment opportunities, created infrastructure, and brought many other benefits to peoples all over the earth. While the British believed in the nobility of that cause, their confidence and conviction enabled the empire to flourish. After the war, what had existed as a trend on the margins of society rapidly spread to the mainstream. The imperial cause that had stirred and animated the people became a source of indifference. The war-weary public's interest in England's far-flung possessions plunged. They redirected their interest toward personal security and comforts. Politicians, recognizing a popular shift away from conservative toward socialist political principles, diverted funds from defense to put toward welfare. Increasingly, the once sacred values that had built the greatest empire in history were jeered by intellectuals. The spirit of condescension and derision was matched by growing fascination with triviality, immorality, and ribaldry. These trends are the death of empire. As Edmund Burke had said in 1775, a great empire and little minds go ill together. This was an abhorrent reaction to the horrors of the Great War. It was a reflection of just how far Britain had fallen away from God. For in that war, the British had suffered a woeful curse. The military setbacks, the agonizing death tolls, had brought them within arm's reach of defeat. They had been spared, but they had forgotten the truth of Psalm 33, that there is no king saved by a multitude of a host. A mighty man is not delivered by much strength. A horse is a vain thing for safety. It is God who determines the outcome of wars. God had given Britain an empire, and God had protected it from ruin, but they gave him no credit. For decades before the war, Britain had increasingly been celebrating its prosperity and magnificence by drifting away from the power that had given it to them. Starting in the upper classes and spreading from there, they were abandoning religion. Church attendance dropped sharply, and embracing secularism, rationalism, permissiveness, decadence, hedonism, and vice. The 1890s were called the Naughty 90s. In the first decade of the new century, Manchester writes, the solid core of agreed religious belief was gone. The Bible had lost its grip on Englishmen. People were groping for a substitute. The new vogues were popular psychology, pragmatism, and Nietzscheanism. The children of 19th century Christian evangelism moved toward a broadening tolerance of all creeds. The people were dazzled by the discoveries and promises of modern science. Well, all this carnality, all these material messiahs were exposed as false gods by the First World War. God used that war to correct the British and the world, to show them that they were not invincible, that empire and even civilization itself are frighteningly fragile. He sought to awaken them from their spiritual stupor, to try to draw them back to himself. Instead, they chose to follow in their wayward path with even greater abandon. Society's slide toward materialism grew steeper. Britain's moral foundation collapsed still further, fueled by a certain fatalism. As the prophet Isaiah said in Isaiah 22, in that day did the Lord God of hosts call to weeping and to mourning and to baldness and to girding with sackcloth. And behold, joy and gladness, slaying oxen and killing sheep, eating flesh and drinking wine. Let us eat and drink, for tomorrow we shall die. A loving God could never allow such self-destructive behavior to go on without trying to correct it. And within a single generation, it led directly into the Second World War. Britain and America today are steeped in the very sins and immorality that Britain was drawn to a century ago. The carnality, the materialism, the idolatry of science and psychology, the decadence, the corruption, the doubt, the faithlessness, the disillusionment, the cynicism, the disbelief in our cause and the loss of our heroes. The factors that hollowed out the strength of the empire and that made it vulnerable to attack, that brought about the curses of a broken will and strength spent in vain, these sins are much further advanced in our nations today. And if we do not turn from those sins in repentance, then the punishment we suffer will be much more devastating. In Leviticus 26, the very chapter where God warns of the curses that come with disobedience, he promises blessings to the nation that obeys him. Then will I give you rain in due season, and the land shall yield her increase, and the trees of the field shall yield their fruit. And I will give peace in the land, and you shall lie down, and none shall make you afraid. And you shall chase your enemies, and they shall fall before you by the sword. And 5 of you shall chase 100, and 100 of you shall put 10,000 to flight, and your enemies shall fall before you by the sword. For I will have respect unto you, and make you fruitful, and multiply you, and establish my covenant with you. And I will walk among you, and will be your God, and you shall be my people. I am the Lord your God, which brought you forth out of the land of Egypt, that you should not be their bondmen. And I have broken the bands of your yoke and made you upright. If only it didn't take another war for us to learn that lesson and to receive those blessings.
This is the voice of the Trumpet News Magazine. You're listening to Trumpet Hour.
Our Jerusalem correspondent, Brent Noctegal, has just returned from the Gaza border in Israel. We have him via Skype to tell us about that trip. Hello, Brent.
Hello.
So what have you seen?
Yeah, today was a really enlightening trip for me. I went with a bus of about 10 journalists to the Gaza border, looking at several of the places that have been hit by rockets that were fired from the Gaza Strip as part of the 430 missile barrage that has been fired Monday night to Tuesday night. And this is one of the largest ever barrages to come out of the Gaza Strip in terms of the thickness of it, basically the amount of missiles.
430 essentially in a 24-hour period?
That's about right. Yeah. And so this really did test the Iron Dome system, and maybe we can talk about that a bit later. We traveled to see, our first stop was visiting Ashkelon. This is a city or a town of about 20,000 people that's about 15 kilometers or 9 miles north of the Gaza Strip, and that's where a Grad rocket hit about 1 a.m. on Monday night. So that would be Tuesday morning. And there is where the fatality occurred. We could tour the building as a four-story building. Basically, one whole side of the building, the apartments on one side of the building are just destroyed, and the man's apartment there's a gaping hole in it. He was in his bed. He actually didn't, the red alert siren did not wake him up. If it had woken him up, he would have had 30 seconds to get down from the fourth floor of this building outside to a safe zone, which these are older houses. Some of the older buildings, they don't have the safe rooms in each of the flats. And so that's the best that he could have done. I doubt he would have made it if he didn't wake up. But just seeing the devastation walking through that building, I could see the room where you died, and I could see it from outside. You could see his bed from outside into the room. And then the other apartments on that side of the building, there was blood just all through them. There was like a hurricane went through. There's two people still in a critical condition from that. And so that was a really a horrific attack. This missile, the Grad rocket that hit it, it seemed to be extremely powerful, similar to the one that hit Beersheba a couple of weeks ago. and it went. This one got through the Iron Dome system. It did not. The Iron Dome did not shoot this one out of the sky. And so from there, there was another missile that landed in Ashkelon. We drove around the corner to visit a man, a resident there, who has a family of four girls, and he was sitting on the couch when another missile came and hit the property just across from him, across the backyard. And they heard the red alert sirens, and they ran to their safe room in their house. The two daughters from upstairs, I think 15 and 11, ran downstairs. And then his wife grabbed the three-year-old girl that was just frozen, didn't know what to do. And he was sitting on the couch across from the blast with his five-month-old child, and just feeding, giving it a bottle. And he jumped up, run into the safe room, closed the door. And then they heard the explosion, comes out, and there's like glass embedded in the couch where he was just sitting, feeding his baby. And what was amazing from just talking to him is the fact that they hate what's going on, and yet they do choose to live there. They choose that they can't move because they feel like it's their land and they should be able to live there and not run away and cower from the terrorist. But he was incredibly hopeful of the future, that something would be able to be worked out down the road. And so there was a number of other stories like that of different people we met. I didn't actually see any missiles. We were at our last stop. We did have to run into the safe room in a restaurant because the red alert siren came over the town that we were in, and the Iron Dome actually hit that rocket out of the sky. But it was like everywhere we went today, and we just basically went from north to south along the Gaza border. Everywhere we went, as soon as we left or just before we got there, they had had some type of missile that had landed in the region or been fired there and shot out of the sky by the Iron Dome. And so everywhere we went also, there was hardly any people out because people were mainly confined to their houses where they had a safe room. Schools were canceled everywhere throughout the South. And so they are in a warlike situation, even though there is no ground attack going on right now.
It seems to me we were talking recently about the Iron Dome and just the possibility that Iran would enact a strategy to try to overwhelm that missile defense system by simply lobbing so many missiles that it wouldn't be able to keep up with it. How did the defense system work? Obviously, a few slipped through here.
Right. Overwhelmingly, the Iron Dome was successful. It did hit 100 missiles out of the sky, or rockets out of the sky out of 400, 25%. They obviously don't choose to target that many. They basically determine, the Iron Dome system's brilliant. It determines whether it's going to land on a populated area or not, and then decides if it is, then it's time to go and attack that missile. And basically a rocket is fired at another rocket. And so there was 25% of them were attacked by Iron Dome. This is a huge increase over the percentage that were fired upon back in 2014, when only about 16% of Hamas's missiles were deemed to be targets for Iron Dome. And I asked the police spokesman about that. What's the significance of that? Does that mean Hamas just got more accurate, or the parameters for Iron Dome, I guess, were increased to ensure that more rockets were taken out of the sky? And he didn't really have an answer for that, but he did say that they felt like Hamas was trying to test the system to see whether they could overwhelm it. And even Palestinian Islamic Jihad, they are the terrorist group, the second largest terrorist group in the Gaza Strip. They released a statement today saying the rocket that attacked, or the missile that attacked Gaza, was something totally different that Israel hasn't seen before. And so watch out is basically their threat. And so, yes, the Iron Dome was successful. Some still got through. Even the big explosion that took place in Sderot, which is about 5 kilometers from the border, bakery exploded. That was because a piece of shrapnel the Iron Dome was fired at an oncoming missile, and the shrapnel fell down and blew up the bakery. So you've got that factor as well. But what's interesting about this is the fact that late this afternoon, it seems that the Israelis are kind of halting their retaliatory strikes. They have struck 150 sites with their airplanes inside the Gaza Strip in retaliation. And a lot of people are up in arms saying, so Hamas decides that they're done and then Israel just folds. And a lot of cabinet members in Israel are very upset with the decision by Mr. Netanyahu. And so it is interesting. Abroad, Mr. Netanyahu is seen as a right winger that can't wait to that is trigger happy and can't wait to fight against the Palestinians. In Israel, he's seen as a dove when it comes to dealing with the Palestinians, dealing with Hamas. And yet it looks like they've decided to hold off further military action this time.
Well, let's just talk about the strategic significance of what's going on here. What's motivating Hamas and what's motivating Netanyahu?
I think Mr. Netanyahu obviously knows a far more than we do in his decision making. What we see is Palestinians attacking or firing rockets at civilians indiscriminately, trying to kill civilian deaths, and Israel's response. And then Hamas stops for a while and that's it. Netanyahu says, we're done. I'm sure there's so much more that goes into it than that. There is plenty of reason to believe that Iran motivated this attack. What precipitated one of the very first acts that took place was a anti-tank missile, guided missile, was fired from the Gaza Strip on, I guess that was Monday morning, I believe. And it hit a bus that had just offloaded 50 soldiers. And they were bordering the Gaza Strip region. And there's footage of this. Anyone can see it online if they so desire. But it's footage that you can see this bus traveling. There's a person who walks in front of it, then explodes. And this is a precision weapon. This is a weapon that you see on the Syrian battlefield. And how in the world does Hamas have accessibility to this weapon that can strike up to about, I think it's 7 or 8 kilometers away? They can guide it to where they want, and it blows something up. That the footage of this, which was taken from only probably 500 meters max away, which is another cause for concern. How did a Hamas operative get so close to Israeli soldiers, which means that he's probably close to the border, if not on the other side of the border? And the first place that footage appeared was on Hezbollah television inside Lebanon. And a lot of commentators are looking at that fact, saying that Hezbollah is obviously just another extension of Iran's armed forces. So, and they're saying that because of that attack and the weapon of choice and the tech and the video and where it surfaced, that Iran was likely behind this, and that Iran is probably trying to encourage a large-scale reaction from the Israeli government. Just because they have more assets in this fight than just Hamas. They have Hezbollah to the north, and many Israeli commentators are saying this is why Mr. Netanyahu's decided this. If he goes in strong right now, diverts resources to the southern front, he's going to have to put a lot of the Iron Dome systems surrounding the Gaza Strip. We just saw 400 rockets. Hamas has 16,000 of them.
Right.
And so if they decide to fire them...
Hezbollah, is that what you mean? Hezbollah?
No. I mean Hamas. They have 16,000 of them. And so if Israel decides we're going to go in strong, they can expect the barrage of rockets, they're going to need to protect the southern front, and therefore they're going to leave their whole northern front exposed to Hezbollah, which has 150,000 rockets and missiles that we can be sure a lot of them are precision guided right now, as we learned over the last couple of weeks that they have that technology. And so I feel like Israel, at least strategically right now, is caught in between a rock and a hard place. Until they find out how to deal with the Lebanese threat of Hezbollah, they're not going to go in strong against Hamas. And just looking at this, we have to see that it is both of these assets are Iranian. They are part of the Iranian fight against Israel. Can be both. They work in tandem. Carolyn Glick had a great point today and some comments that she made. And she said, precipitating the Second Lebanon War that we call the Second Lebanon War back in 2006 was a mini battle, or a battle between Hamas and Israel. They did the same thing. They fired a barrage of rockets. Israel tried to protect their southern front. And then a couple weeks later, we have the same thing taking place from Hezbollah in the north. And so she says that was the first Israel-Iran war, and Iran is preparing for a second one, and they're trying to use Hamas to try and motivate Israel to dedicate too many resources there in the south.
That is a chilling assessment of what is going on here. Really, the overall picture that Iran is the perpetrator and they're the mastermind behind it is something that it's consistent with what we've seen for quite some time. But this amplification, this ramping up of their aggression against Israel, it doesn't seem to be abating whatsoever.
No, it doesn't. And I mean, I think Israel has considered its military to be far superior for a long time from anything else in the Middle East. And I do believe that a lot in the government and even the Israeli public now are recognizing the fact that there is a war coming. It's only a matter of time, and it is going to be catastrophic. I'm not just, you know, making this up. This isn't me talking. This is Israeli military officials saying if Hezbollah decides to act with Hamas, there's only so much we can do. We'll win, they say. We'll definitely win, but it's going to be absolute mass casualties on Israel's side. And they are looking at this scenario. And basically right now, it seems that the ball is in Iran's court to determine when it arcs up.
Well, that's amazing. Well, if you want more information, and really it's important just watching the way that this is escalating in Israel, to go back to the booklet by Gerald Flory, Jerusalem in Prophecy. It's really provides the perspective on what's happening over there within the context of biblical prophecy, which is it just provides the context that we need in order to understand just how grave the situation is. But to hear those officials in Israel making those statements and dealing with the threats that they are on a day-to-day basis is quite chilling. We've been talking with trumpet writer Brent Nachtigall, who just returned from a visit to the Gaza border there in Israel. Do keep your eyes on thetrumpet.com for more information about that. And thank you so much for your time, Brent.
No problem.
This is Trumpet Hour with Joel Hilliker.
The Trumpet's publisher and editor-in-chief, Gerald Flory, just held a personal appearance campaign in Columbus, Ohio, this past Sunday and Monday nights, speaking to Trumpet subscribers. We'll get a report on this and a new radio show to begin airing on Trumpet Radio next week from Grant Turgeon.
Trumpet editor-in-chief Gerald Flory flew to Columbus, Ohio on November 11th for a two-day personal appearance campaign with Trumpet subscribers. The campaign was Mr. Flory's seventh such event since restarting the lecture series in July 2017. Mr. Flory made the trip on the Philadelphia Church of God's Gulfstream 450 jet, departing Oklahoma City just before 8 a.m. and arriving in Columbus around 10:45 local time. Stewardess Paris Turgeon spoke about the logistics of meal preparation and service aboard the plane.
I usually start my preparations for the trips about 2 weeks in advance. I start by brainstorming menu ideas, trying to think of things that are doable on the airplane. It's a very small space, and with the short flights, like anything that's under 2 hours, it's a really quick time to make a meal and then get it all cleared and place settings picked up by the time the plane lands. So, yeah, 2 weeks out, I normally start brainstorming. I'm limited. I don't have a stovetop, so everything needs to go in the oven. I usually will plan a menu, usually have two options. I will practice both of those options on the ground in the home ec department room. That's where I will do all the cooking and food prep. Preparation is key. You want to have anything that needs to be chopped, sliced, anything like that. Anything that I can do before I get on the plane makes it easier just because the space is so small. So I try to bring everything as done as it can be before we get on there.
Headquarters evangelist Wayne Turgeon marveled at the Gulfstream 450's impact on God's work.
As much as I wanted to talk about the pack itself, I am honored to be able to mention the experience of being on the plane. And after 40 some years of flying commercially, there's nothing to compare with being on a private plane where you have leg room and you've got great service, food, fellowship. It's such a blessing for God's servant in this end time, like Mr. Armstrong, to have that luxury. And while, you know, we have to still take the commercial flights for other trips and visits, it's helped really that we can even incorporate this plane for other regional directors, perhaps when they have to go to their areas and overseas again. I know that Mr. Stephen Fleury could get some more miles out of this wonderful tool to get this work done in this end time. And coming up to these PACs, it is an exciting extension of the work at headquarters for Mr. Fleury to be able to press the flesh, to be able to meet a lot of the people that are listening to him, watching him, and are really excited about the message that they have told me when I was in line trying to meet a lot of these people before Mr. Fleury talked with them, that they're just not hearing anywhere else. There were some that came from many hours and miles away from different surrounding states that would love to be here for both nights. Obviously, they have to work, many of them, and they have to get back home, which necessitates the smaller night on the second night. But I don't know if they would have much larger numbers if we could just make this available in these respective regions where these people are coming from. Some drove from Kentucky, Michigan, Indiana, and I'm probably missing a few of the locations for hours. And some of these individuals are older, not in the greatest of health, but like Mr. Fleury, they were willing to stand in line for, I would say, probably a good 2 hours. That would include the members at the end who patiently let some of the new prospects meet with Mr. Fleury first. And it was interesting to hear that everyone had a unique story as to how they came in contact, either, you know, through online or catching the program. Or one lady and her husband, she was at the doctor's office, and I said, "Well, wow, you really have to tell Mr. Fleury about that, because I think we're going to go nationwide now with a waiting room program." So all of them, you know, really, I even heard a man a couple rows behind me last night saying over and over again, "Amen," and "Hallelujah," you know, quietly, but in total agreement, especially when Mr. Fleury would comment about how our nation is going down. There has so many problems. It's really sick right now, and it needs intervention from God. It's going to take a miracle to even protect those that have faith to get out of here. How quickly everything is collapsing all around us. So just a pleasure and a privilege to be able to come on this and to represent headquarters, to be an extra assistant to Mr. Fleury in this great commission. And all the brethren need to be praying in minute detail for the safety, the weather, the technical, the message, the response, and that we can keep doing this until we are not able to pass over all the cities of Israel and get this phase of the work done.
Once the plane touched down, PCG Northeast United States Regional Director Cal Culpepper and Ohio Minister Victor Vigil transported Mr. Fleury and company to the Hilton Doubletree Hotel, where the campaign lectures were held. Audio-video technician Joshua Sloan spoke about the extensive preparations that church staff members and volunteers undertook before the meetings on both days.
It really was all hands on deck. All the volunteers sprung into action. All of them were very helpful. You know, Mr. Havens, who was in charge of hospitality, he got his crews together. We started preparing all the scanners and devices to check people in, to request literature, and got them all trained on those devices. And then I had to jump over and start setting up the sound equipment where we patched into their house. And in the process of that, testing the projector screens, the slideshows, the video presentations, and, of course, setting up multiple backups in case anything that was said needed to be used later. This was the first one that we've done where we uploaded Mr. Fleury's first part of his message same day afterwards. That was a unique and very cool experience to be a part of, to see something turned around so fast. And again, that couldn't have been done without a lot of people chipping in and helping. And there's a lot that goes on behind the scenes, but with everybody pulling their weight and stepping up and helping, we were able to accomplish a lot.
After a short introductory video at 3:30 p.m., Mr. Fleury spoke for 75 minutes to 276 Trumpet subscribers, 132 of whom were non-church members. He discussed French President Emmanuel Macron's recent statement about needing a European army and about the need for France to defend itself against the United States. You can find the video of this segment of the lecture at thetrumpet.com. For the second part of the lecture, Mr. Fleury spoke about the titanic battle of the ages between Jesus Christ and Satan the devil. After defeating Satan and qualifying to rule the world at his second coming, Christ declared, "The kingdom of God is at hand." Mr. Fleury explained how this is true because Christ established his church, which is the kingdom of God in embryo. Afterward, Mr. Fleury chatted with subscribers for 2.5 hours. He said he was impressed with their excitement and interest in the message. Mr. Vigil, the Ohio minister, reflected on the message and on the impact it made on the audience.
I thought the second part was especially great for the Trumpet subscribers and for anybody who was out there who would be interested in attending services with the One True Church, because he really highlighted the fact that there is a One True Church. There would be until Christ returns, and if not, that would make Christ out to be a liar. So I think it just highlighted the special opportunity that those God is calling have to be a part of the kingdom of God in embryo, to be a part of the One True Church, and just tying that in with the concepts of repentance and faith, just giving them direction on how to make that a reality.
At 7:30 p.m. on November 12th, Mr. Fleury delivered the second campaign lecture to 115 Trumpet subscribers, 36 of them non-church members. He talked about the biblical book of Hebrews, the God family vision, and building the very faith of Jesus Christ. As a result of the personal appearance campaign, between 15 and 20 non-church member subscribers signed up to attend follow-up Bible studies the next two Sundays. Trumpet staffers will be sending a letter to those who attended the campaign, inviting them to register for the follow-up Bible studies. In other words, for those who didn't sign up at the campaign, it's not too late. Mr. Culpepper, the Northeast U.S. Regional Director, gave his thoughts on the second message and his goals for the follow-up Bible studies, which he will deliver.
The people who come to follow-up Bible studies, that's when you really find out who really has the interest. Usually that puts us in front of them again. So we had contact with them at the PAC. Then we get to have additional contact with them at the Bible study. Now, that moves things along pretty quick, because they're going to come up and talk to us after the Bible studies, and that's when you begin to really start finding the ones that are serious and want to move forward. So it really helps qualify for the ministry, who is God working with and who do we need to be focused on.
Due to the threat of bad weather in the area, Mr. Fleury left right after the lecture on the second night. The G450 took off before 10 p.m., and touched down in Oklahoma City at 11:30 local time.
Well, thank you for that, Grant. So you got a lot of other people's opinions. You talked to several people here, but let's hear your opinion. You've been on a few of these. You've probably been on more of these than just about anybody now, because you've accompanied Mr. Fleury on all of these trips. Talk a little bit about your experiences and how you felt like, say, this one differed from those other ones.
Well, every experience is pretty exciting, just because you know going into it that it's going to be a really quick day and a half long trip,
right,
and a lot's going to get accomplished in that amount of time. And it is really exciting just to see the dedication of everyone involved, from the ministers to the members to even all the people who show up a couple hours before the meeting even starts. Just Trumpet subscribers, even just there to talk to everyone and to look at the literature tables. There's all kinds of free literature you can get. This time, there were cookies and drinks that people could have on the side, so that kind of made it more appealing for people to show up early or to stay after and talk for a while. So that was one thing, one small thing that was different.
It does seem like the time before and after, obviously the lecture is really important, but it seems like that personal contact that Mr. Fleury has with subscribers, and then those who say the ministers who are there, the church members who are there to talk with them, that's also a pretty big part of the package, isn't it?
It really is. I mean, the first lecture ended around 4:45 p.m. And people stayed until 7:15 or 7:30.
Wow.
Talking with him. It was almost like they didn't think they needed to go get dinner. They were just really excited to talk to him. And one thing that was different about this campaign than the six other ones that we've had so far, Mr. Fleury just talked about how excited the people were. And he also mentioned that he was very direct and blunt this time, like probably more than any of the other ones by quite a bit.
Well, that is interesting. He's been talking about just the responsibility that we have to make sure that we're being clear and direct in talking, you know, issuing God's warning, and not just giving them a warning, but giving them a call to action and helping people to recognize their responsibility to actually do something with this information. It's not enough just to hear about it and kind of think, well, that's a lovely song that he's singing, but to actually take action.
That's probably the biggest, most important purpose of the campaigns. It is a lot different from anything that he would write on the Trumpet website or anything that he would say at in a Key of David program. He's just very direct, because these are people that not only read the message or watch the message, they're also taking the time to drive several hours in a lot of cases just to show up and see it in person. So you already know by definition with that they are pretty serious about learning. And because of that, they get a much more direct message in person.
So it was on this trip that Mr. Fleury actually talked to you about creating a new program for Trumpet Radio that specifically focuses in on the news of the work, on what's happening, campaigns like this one. Tell us about that.
Well, that was a pretty big surprise to me, and it was also very exciting to hear about that. He wants to have a program called Behind the Work, and the plan for that is to do it 11:30 a.m. local time until 12 noon, and that'll lead into the replay of the Trumpet Daily Radio Show at noon on Monday. And the point of that is just to give people an idea of what's happening in God's work. There can be all kinds of interviews with various department heads or other staff members. A big part of it is going to be going through Mr. Armstrong's autobiography, Mr. Herbert W. Armstrong's autobiography. So that is something that you can find at thetrumpet.com. That book is obviously all about doing the work. So there will be parts of the program that's talking about that book, and then all kinds of interviews and all kinds of different features about what is happening.
Well, we've been talking with Grant Turgeon, Gerald Fleury's personal assistant. He just got back from a personal appearance campaign with the PCG Pastor General this past Sunday and Monday in Columbus, Ohio. And some exciting news there, the announcement of a new radio program on Trumpet Radio, Behind the Work. You can listen to that 11:30 next Monday, the inaugural program of this this new program that we'll have. 11:30 on Monday on thetrumpet.com, the Listen Live feature there, the radio button, or here locally in Edmond, Oklahoma on 101.3 KPCG. Thanks so much for your time.
Really enjoyed it. Thank you.
It's time for today's last word.
Our life is frittered away by detail, wrote Thoreau. Simplicity, simplicity, simplicity. I say, let your affairs be as two or three, not 100 or 1,000. He wrote that in 1854. What would this man think of the life-frittering details that consume us in the Twitter age?
Contemplating this, I recently picked up Farrar Fenton's translation of the Bible in my study. A friend gave me a copy a while back, but it wasn't until that morning that I realized I was in possession of something quite awesome and inspiring. At the beginning of this massive volume is a note to my inquiring friends from the translator. It is Mr. Fenton's explanation of why he, a British businessman in the 19th century, undertook the mammoth project of translating the entire Bible. It's a testament to the manly sense of duty, determination, sacrifice, perseverance, and big-mindedness behind this book. It truly stirred my imagination. Fenton paraphrases a Professor Karl Baer of Munich, who taught, "The best established doctrine of historical philosophy was that all the power, prosperity, and mental energy of a race or nation sprang from and lived by its religion. That when the religion ceased to be its faith, that is, its energizing principle, the intellect, power, vigor, and prosperity of that race or nation died away in proportion and ultimately perished, both mentally and physically." How true, and how painfully relevant in our aggressively secularist age. Fenton then says this, "The position the British race has won in the world is founded upon the religion which takes as its origin the Bible. And therefore, I am convinced that with the decay of faith in the scriptures, our national vigor and prosperity as a race will waste away, not only in the British Isles, but as with all races, in every state or colony sprung from them. Consequently, I will try at least to avert or retard so great a catastrophe and calamity to the whole of mankind. I have decided, God helping me, to execute the work you see I am doing." Why translate the entire Bible into modern English? Fenton said, "My object is to try and save the British race from decay and dissolution by restoring to it the vital element of faith in revelation. For unless its faith is revived, our doom is certain." I find several things about this astounding. The fact that this man recognized so clearly the importance of Bible-based faith to national health and prosperity, even survival. That he particularly believed this to be true of Britain and its empire and of America, that he knew the decline of these nations would be a catastrophe and a calamity to the world. In 1910, when Fenton wrote this introduction to his Bible translation, he quoted a critic of his work who said, "Nobody cares a halfpenny for the Bible." A century later, that indifference has turned to outright hatred. We live in a Britain and an America that are increasingly making adherence to biblical truth a crime punishable by the state. This all made Fenton's words stir me as I read them, but there's something more. I'm also deeply impressed that this man possessed such determined focus to try to single-handedly prevent or at least delay this catastrophe using the means he believed God inspired him to. Fenton perceived a need for a modern translation of the Bible. He recognized this was a task nobody else would undertake. So what did he do? He got started. And then he didn't stop until he finished. He wrote this, "I saw the need also, not only as a student, but from intercourse with all classes of my countrymen, and God inspired me with courage to undertake it, and with inborn perseverance during a period of 50 years to carry it through by devoting every leisure moment of a busy commercial life to the preparation for and execution of that one object." It was in 1853, at the same time that Thoreau was walking the woods of Walden Pond, that Fenton started this mammoth undertaking. He finished in 1903 at the age of 71. It's astonishing what singular devotion to an important task can yield. How critical it is that we prune out those life-frittering details and make the very most of the brief time we possess. For today, too, there is a great work to be done in the shadow of looming catastrophe. It demands courage, perseverance, and devotion to that one object. Simplicity, simplicity, simplicity.
I'm Joel Hilliker, and that'll do it for today's Trumpet Hour. Send us your comments on the program by emailing letters@thetrumpet.com. Thanks to my guests, Brent Nachtigall and Grant Turgeon. Thanks to our technical staff, Dwight Falk and Josh Sloan. I'll leave you with this thought from Publilius Syrus. Learn to see in another's calamity the ills which you should avoid. Thank you for joining us on Trumpet Hour. Until next time, keep watching your world.
Listening to Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio, 101.3 KPCG, and online at kpcg.fm. Understand your world.